Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
My name is Hal, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a sensitive alcoholic. It's been said that we alcoholics are extremely sensitive people. I used to introduce myself at AA meetings by saying my name was Dr. Ding-a-ling, and I was a wino and a pill head. And were I doing it the way I choose to do it, I would still introduce myself the same way. Bill, you're awfully nervous. You left a live one up here. Wait a minute. I'm shaking so I can't put it out. But you know how it is. This fellowship that you belong to, I presume, and I am pleased to say I thank God belong to, has what I call some of the best ego deflation mechanisms in it I've ever run into. And it's something that we alkies kind of need, I regret to say. I had been going around introducing myself in typical egotistical alcoholic fashion by saying, my name is Dr. Ding-a-ling and I'm a wino and a pill head. I refuse to say my name is Hal and I'm an alcoholic. And then a couple of people got me aside and they said, what's the matter? Are you too good to be a drunk? So I got back in line and I say my name is Hal and I'm an alcoholic. The ego-deflating mechanisms of Alcoholics Anonymous are, to me, one of the most fascinating facets of this whole way of life, as we call it. In an effort to qualify myself as an alcoholic, speaking at AA group meetings on occasion, I would always make reference to the fact, you know, that at one point in my wino career, I got put in jail in the Lincoln Heights City Jail in Los Angeles. By the way, are there any alumni of Lincoln Heights besides me here tonight? Don't be ashamed. I've been to AA meetings from one side of this ocean to the other, and I've never failed to run into a Lincoln Heights alumni wherever I've gone. The noble institution called Lincoln Heights is the city jail in Los Angeles. And at one point in my wino career, I made the Lincoln Heights city jail on a common drunk arrest 3 times in one day. I recognize that social drinkers don't do this sort of thing, and so I usually use this as a reference point to qualify myself as an alcoholic. And you know, this business of speaking at AA meetings is an insidious thing. You get so you listen to your own self-talk, and this gets to be a form of self-hypnotism. I'm reminded of a story that a friend of mine in AA tells about a fellow who, God didn't give him many talents, but he did give him one talent, which it took him a while to find out what it was. He tried selling things. He wasn't a salesman. He tried making things. He wasn't a carpenter. He tried laying bricks. He wasn't a mason. Everything he tried just went kaput. And then one day, quite by accident, he discovered what talent God had given him. He happened to pick up a flute and start playing it. And there was a snake nearby, and he charmed the damn snake. That's an odd talent to have, to be able to charm snakes, but he was good at it. So this fellow set about to make a career of charming snakes, and he went all over the country playing this flute and charming snakes. And he got quite a reputation as a snake charmer. In fact, it got so that when he'd come to a town or a hamlet or a city, there'd be a great crowd of people waiting on him, waiting to watch him play this flute and charm snakes. And then one day, as he was playing the flute, and there was a large group of people around, unfortunately for him, he played the flute too well. Instead of charming the snake, he charmed himself. And when this happened, of course, he fell out in what can only be described as a spasm of self-indulgence and egotistical ecstasy. He lay there wreathing on the ground, totally delighted with what he had done. And of course, when this happened, he stopped playing the flute. And when he stopped playing the flute, it broke the spell on the snake. And the snake raised up and bit the old fella, and the poor fella died of snake bite. Well, you know, this is what happens to you when you talk too much at AA meetings. You not care if you'll get snake bit. And I had listened to myself qualify myself as an alcoholic by saying that I got put in the Lincoln Heights City Jail 3 times in one day once, to a point where I've decided in my alcoholic egotistical thinking that I had a world's record. Nobody in all this fellowship of ex-drunks could equal my record as a drunk. There are fellows who've been in jail more often than I have. There are fellows who've been in more jails than I have. Fellows have done more total jail time than I did. But who in the wide scope of AA could say that they had been in Lincoln Heights 3 times in one day on a drunk charge? Nobody but me. Oh, blessed little me. As I say, this fellowship has these ego-deflating mechanisms in it. And God, as I understand him, took care of this little thing. One night at an AA meeting in Manhattan Beach in Southern California, I made mention of the fact that I, the great drunk, got put in Lincoln Heights City Jail 3 times in one day once on a common drunk charge. And oh, wasn't I the greatest drunk that God ever made. When the meeting was over, a little fella came up to me. I would judge his age as at least in his 60s. He came up to about this high on me. He had a real ruddy complexion, a good, firm, solid, masculine grip when he took my hand, and eyes that I shall never forget because they just danced with that mischievous joy of happy sobriety. He looked at me and he said, "Doc, I've got you beat." I said, "What do you mean you've got me beat?" He said, "Doctor, I made 3 different jails in 3 different cities once in one day, once on a drunk charge." These are the ego-deflating mechanisms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to refer to people in Alcoholics Anonymous who had been dry longer than I had as bleeding deacons. This is really casting aspersions at them. To be honest with you, I resented the fact that they'd been sober longer than I had. How dare they do that to me? So I called them disdainfully bleeding deacons. Not too many weeks ago, I was asked to speak at an AA intergroup meeting in a metropolitan area in a city in another state. Some friends of mine knew I was going to go to this meeting, and so they got in touch with me, and they said, "When you get over there, be sure and meet so-and-so. Give her our very best. She is a very wonderful person," and this and that and the other. And sure enough, when we arrived at the auditorium where the meeting was to be held, this person came out of the coffee room, which was adjacent to the auditorium, and walked up. And the gentleman who had met my plane said, "This is so-and-so." And this was the person whom so many people in Los Angeles had told me to be sure and meet, and what a wonderful AA she was. Snotty, alcoholic me. I look at this charming woman, a woman obviously of many years sobriety, well-dressed, cultured. I later learned she had been her general service representative for her state. And snotty, alcoholic me. I look at her and I say, "Well, I'm certainly glad to meet the bleeding deacon from the city." She said to me, she said, "Doctor, I would much rather be called the shining beacon. And by the way, what did you say your name was?" These are a few examples of the ego-deflating mechanisms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Your chairman tonight made mention of the fact that there are some people here whom I know and who know me. And to you, shining beacons, who are here tonight, I'm going to ask your tolerance and your patience if you'll forgive me for a repetition of something that I know some of you have heard before, but it will be a brief resume of my alcoholic story. I feel that it's a speaker's responsibility, particularly if there are those in the audience who are perhaps new, or who are relatively new, or who haven't heard the speaker before, that he at least gives something of his personal alcoholic background story to help perhaps that person identify themselves and take something home perhaps from the meeting that will be of help to them. And so for you shining beacons, please be tolerant with me. To show you that I'm not at all nervous, I had a perfectly good story which I didn't tell Art, who met my plane, because I knew if I told him, he'd go around and tell each and every one of you, and then I would have no opportunity to use it. And Bill said he was nervous, and I didn't want to tell him I was nervous, but I saw how nervous he was, so I got nervous, and I forgot my story. But you know, we just completed an election, and there's been a rather profundity of election stories going around, but I did hear of one the other day that I thought was awfully good. The scene of this particular story was actually on election day. And on election day, it seems as though Mrs. Goldwater was talking to Mrs. Johnson. And Mrs. Goldwater said to Mrs. Johnson, said, "You know, Mrs. Johnson, there is a possibility that by this time tomorrow night, I'll be sleeping with the next president of the United States." Lady Bird looked at Mrs. Goldwater, and she said, "That Lyndon, there isn't anything he wouldn't do for a vote." One of my personal trademarks as a, shall we say, a speaker, if that's the word, I don't like it, but as one who occasionally is asked to talk at AA meetings, I do have a little personal trademark. I have many resentments. I have many frustrations. I suffer from some of the same defects of character in more or less degree that we all learn as alcoholics we have. One of my prime resentments is against a branch of medicine known as psychiatry. And I have to do something about my resentments, and so one of the ways I handle this situation is by telling a story about wig pickers. My current favorite story about wig pickers involves a psychiatrist in Los Angeles who had had a patient under treatment for some time. At this particular seance between the disciple of Freud and his patient, he said to this poor bewildered young man, "Now you seem to be getting along all right now. As a matter of fact, you seem to be doing pretty well, so I don't think it'll be necessary for you to come and see me again for a while." The patient said, "Well, doctor, may I kiss you goodbye?" And the reflex detective said, "No, young man, I don't think you should do that. And besides that, we really shouldn't be lying here together on this couch this way anyway." For want of a better place to start, I usually begin my genesis into the field of alcoholism about the year 1952. In February of that year, I spent 6 days as a guest of the state of California at the Napa State Hospital up at Imola. I went to that fine institution in a straitjacket from Marin County, where I had been committed upon the sworn testimony of 14 physicians, all personal friends of mine, who in the middle of the night got a superior court judge out of bed and said, "Dr. Smith has flipped his lid. He must be put away." And when 14 doctors get a judge up in the middle of the night, it makes an impression on him. And so he signed the order, and the boys came and got me, and they took me away to the Napa State Hospital. I don't remember too much about this. I remember waking up in a wire cage, without any clothes on, and there were two attendants washing my body down with a garden hose. Now, I can assure you again, as I said earlier, social drinkers do not get themselves in this sort of situation. So I think I could say, without too much equivocation, somewhere in here I had crossed the line, if there be one, between social and pathological drinking. I didn't stay too long at Napa that particular time. I happened to be an Episcopalian. Not a very good one, but an Episcopalian. And in my conniving alcoholic thinking, I remembered somewhere that even a condemned man awaiting execution was entitled to religious counsel. And so I demanded to see a Catholic priest. The gentleman of the Roman church that they sent to see me was a nice, kind, doting little old father whom the bishop should have put out to pasture a long time ago. But his charge was the giggle factory up on the north end of the bay. And he's the man who came to see me. And I did a typical alcoholic thing. I handed this guy the biggest con job you've ever seen. I told this poor father that I was teetering on the brink of Catholicism. I was just about to take the step into becoming a Roman Catholic. And with this, his hands began to, his mouth began to water, his eyes lit up. And I told him how a doctor friend of mine who was a Roman Catholic was responsible for this change in thinking that I was going through. And now that I was in all this difficulty, if I could just talk to this man for a few minutes, I'm sure I could make a decision. And I would become a Roman Catholic. Isn't that an awful thing to do? It got what I wanted, and so many times I think we alcoholics are governed by, as the book says, we want what we want when we want it. And sometimes we'll damn near do anything to get it. That afternoon, the doctor who was to push me over into the brink of Catholicism arrived at the hospital, summoned by the priest. I didn't want to become a Catholic. I just wanted to get a hold of this doctor buddy of mine to spring me. And when he arrived, his opening words were, "Blankety, blankety, blank, what in the blankety, blank are you doing in here?" And I said, "I don't know, but I want the hell out. Get me a lawyer." And he did. He got me a lawyer. And I walked out of the Napa State Hospital through a writ of habeas corpus with a little certificate in my hand that was almost to be my death certificate. This certificate was signed and had the state of California seal and everything on it, but it said that I was a guy who would never need the second step. I was not insane. I was restored to society with all my rights and privileges, and the hospital was terribly sorry about the grave injustice. But I'm an alcoholic. Now, I have all the educational requirements as set up by various agencies and boards and what have you to practice medicine and surgery in this state. I had a rather rigorous training period and educational period, but just to show you how smart I really am, we're in my lawyer's car, we're riding out of the Napa State Hospital. I've just gone through 6 days that I wouldn't put a dog through. I won't say that I like dogs. I wouldn't put a ape through it. I turned to this lawyer. See, I'm brilliant. I'm educated. I know all the answers. I'm a doctor, specialist and certified. I turned to this lawyer who's performed the legal miracle of the century. I say, "George, I want to thank you for what you've done. This has been an awful experience. Let's stop somewhere and have a drink. I need one." See, I knew what was wrong. I understood. And I got very infuriated at this legal counsel of mine when he wouldn't consent to my having a drink. How intolerant, how what an head this man is. Won't let me stop and have a little drink after all I've been through. Needless to say, as soon as I got the opportunity to get away from my lawyer, I went right back to the bottle. Now, I'm not going to bore you with a long recitation of all the bottles of whiskey I drank. It would be impossible for me to remember them. But I would like to review some of those early days of the compulsive, addictive drinking. Particularly the things that transpired in the relationship to my thinking. To me, the disease of alcoholism is characterized by more than just the excessive compulsive drinking. We show so many other symptoms that are so characteristically of alcoholics or alcoholism other than our drinking, mostly in our actions and particularly in our thinking. As a result of my drinking, like some of you, I can begin to experience increasing difficulties. Social difficulties, professional difficulties, financial difficulties. And I was recently working with a young doctor in Los Angeles, and it just tickled the heck out of me when he had a little slip over the weekend and got him back in the fold now. And I talked to him in his office on Monday. He says, geez, I'm scared to death to answer the phone. I don't remember what I did Saturday night. And I laughed like hell. I couldn't help it. I said, gee whiz, isn't that wonderful? That was me 12 years ago. But in my sober moments, and there were some sober moments, I realized that things weren't going the way they supposed to go or the way I wanted them to go. I wanted them to go. And I did some thinking about this, and I knew something was wrong. I've never been an atheist or an agnostic. I happen to have been in the Navy during the latter part of the war with the Japanese Empire. And I was in a few spots over there, not too tight, but a little bit tight, where I can agree with the philosophy of the Pacific that there are no atheists in the foxholes. So anything that I could say about ever having been an atheist or an agnostic would be phony. I say this, and I say it in all sincerity. My real spiritual values have come in Alcoholics Anonymous. But as for being an atheist, agnostic, no. And thinking about these things that were happening to me, I got a kind of a weird idea. I decided that wherever life is made, some spiritual or greater power is responsible for it. And since this is true, it must be an awful busy place, because this greater thing than myself has to make ants and trees and bugs and bees and human beings and grass and potatoes and birds and fish. This factory of life must be an awful big, busy place where God creates this sort of thing. And the way I worked it out was that in this factory of God's where life is made, probably what happened was something like this. About the time that my model came through on the conveyor belt there, you know, in the plant, somebody in the joint said, "Hey, God," and the guy looked up to see what he wanted. And right at that moment, I went on through. The quality control that day was not too good, you know. In other words, there was a tappet or a screw or a bolt or a nut that hadn't had that final winch put on it, you know. And so I had better set about getting this fixed. Being a physician, I turned to my own profession for help in this matter, and I, as some of you have told me you did, I went through rigorous physical examinations. They turned me upside down, they punched me, they poked me. And really, there wasn't anything physically, a little few minor this and that and other, touch of dander, flat feet, you know, but nothing that could qualify me for what all was happening to me. And after repeated examinations and consultations and progressive disorder of alcoholism always ensuing with ever-increasing ferocity, I finally talked to a couple of these doctors, and they said, "Smitty, maybe you need a little help with some of your emotional problems. You know, this could have a lot to do with what's wrong." And so reluctantly, but upon their insistence, I agreed to go see a wig picker. Now, I arranged to see a psychiatrist who had his office down the street from mine. I knew the fellow. I'd seen him scurrying around the hospital once in a while like a pack rat, you know. We had another wig picker in town. I didn't know him as well. And one day I remember I was walking through the corridor of the hospital, and this one wig picker passed the other wig picker, and this one wig picker said to the other wig picker, and he said, "How's your wife?" The other says, "Better than nothing. How's yours?" And this wig picker, as I say, was down the street, not very convenient. And so we worked out a schedule whereby I would see him on Tuesdays and Thursday afternoons. And so I worked out my schedule so that in the early part of the afternoon I could be free from my responsibilities at the office on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Now, I don't want to pick on anyone here in the audience particularly, but my friend from Sacramento, supposing in your drinking days you suddenly had Tuesday and Thursday afternoon off, what would you have done? Well, I can only tell you what I did. I worked like a beaver Tuesday and Thursday morning. Did everything off the desk, every patient out of the office, everything all up just snuff, everything in good shape, batting down the hatches. Then I would go in the laboratory of my office. I would get down a bottle of this laboratory ethyl alcohol. This stuff's 190 proof. I would pour out a finger or two of this in a beaker, cut it with a little water, and down it. In those days, I had early learned the use of a drug called barbiturates, or goofballs, as we call them in AA. And many's the morning when I have gotten up and wished I could take a drink, but I didn't dare because I'd be in the hospital or surgery, and to calm those jittery nerves and queasy stomach, I'd pop one of these little goofballs in my mouth in lieu of taking the morning drink. When I could take the morning drink, I took it. When I could get it to stay down. But I would always carry, there are none there tonight, thank God. But I'd always carry two or three of these little goofballs around here in this inner upper coat pocket, and I'd reach in there and pop one or two of these in my mouth, wash them down with alcohol. I happened to do ear, nose, and throat work, and there was a drug we used to use a great deal. We still occasionally use it, but we have other drugs now that do our work as well, if not better, and are not as dangerous. But the drug that we used to use so much was a drug called cocaine. This is a narcotic, you know. I would take my alcohol, I'd wash down my goofballs, and then I'd go in one of the treatment rooms and spray my nose with cocaine. And then down the street I'd go to see my wig picker. But I'm not insane. I've got a certificate from the state of California to prove I am not insane. And you wonder, as I used to wonder, why these seances with this wig picker aren't doing me any good. You know, I'm just getting worse all the time. He's not helping me either. But like so many who have the problem of compulsive drinking, I couldn't recognize the fault that lay within me. And like so many who have had a problem with excessive drinking, I, like others have told me they did, I blamed my problems on something else. In this case, I blamed the wig picker. Why, it's all his fault that I'm having all. He's not helping me. And I finally decided that as a wig picker, he just wasn't any good. I decided not only was he not a good wig picker, he was a small town wig picker. I needed a super specialist to take care of me and my problems. I decided that what I had wrong with me was totally different from what anybody else had ever had wrong with them. Does this sound familiar? Mine was an unusual, different case. And so, without going into a lot of extraneous detail, then I started on what can only be called as a psychiatric kick. I flipped and I flopped from psychiatrist to psychiatrist, mental hospital to mental hospital, both on this coast and on the East Coast. I spent what was a small fortune and a lot of time seeking a solution to this problem and not finding it in the annals of psychiatry. Meantime, my alcoholism as a progressive illness is rapidly, fantastically progressing. To condense this thing for the sake of brevity, because I have a theory relative to Alcoholics Anonymous that the mind can only absorb what the seat can endure. And some of you have been in here a long time already tonight. Within a period of a year, I am no longer the well-to-do, affluent, young specialist with all avenues opening to him and all the future looking rosy. By now, I'm a full-fledged wino within a year living on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And it was at this point that I made the Lincoln Heights City Jail 3 times in 1 day. It's not just a euphonious statement to say that my name was Dr. Ding-a-ling. This was the name given to me by the members of the LAPD. We used to have to put me in the ding-a-ling tank at the city jail on more than one occasion. I'm the type of alcoholic who, once he got onto the jug, when he was forcibly separated from it, was the only way I could be separated was by force. When the jug and I parted company, that little sack of marbles that I occasionally carried around with me just opened up and the marbles just went all over the floor. I lost my wits. I was the victim of frequent hallucinations. I was a frequent victim of convulsions, DTs, etc. ad infinitum. I once heard a speaker talk who said that when he drank, he lost his marbles too, just as I did. The time I heard him talk, he said he hadn't had a drink in 10 years. He said he thought through the AA program he'd managed to recover most of his marbles. His problem now was he couldn't find the damn bag that they came in. Because of this conduct and because of this sort of behavior, the Board of Medical Examiners of the sovereign state of California saw fit to seek me out and through issuance of a subpoena dragged me on the carpet. At a hearing that was held in Los Angeles, my conduct, my behavior, my attitude, my jail record, all this was brought up and aired in embarrassing, intimate detail, and I had to sit and listen to this terrible, terrible thing. It seems as though I was charged with unprofessional conduct, and it was also officially charged by the Deputy Attorney General of the State of California that the evidence submitted indicated that I was unworthy to hold a license to practice medicine and surgery in this state. How dare they do that to me? Can't do that. The man conducting the hearing bent over backwards to give me a break. He really did. But the evidence was overwhelming, and at the conclusion of the hearing, he informed me that unless I did something about my drinking, unless I did something about my attitude, my behavior, my way of life, unless I did something about this business of getting in jail so much, there would be no other course except to revoke my license. Because these charges were true. He informed me that from that moment forward, my conduct, my behavior would be under constant surveillance. In other words, I would be tailed or watched all the time. It's been said that you can't scare an alcoholic sober, and this is perhaps true. I'm not going to argue the pros and cons of that, but I think sometimes a scare can be a lever or a fulcrum to motivate temporarily a guy or a gal who's got a drinking problem into facing it, but I know this. As a result of this, I did go to some AA meetings in Los Angeles. I don't remember just how many. Not very many. But I went to enough meetings to grasp something that became very dear to me. At these AA meetings that I attended, I met the man that was to become, and were he still alive today, would have been my original sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's gone to the big meeting upstairs now. But the thing other than that that I grasped and that I still have to retain to this day is the thing that you people told me about drinking. You told me it was the first drink that got me drunk. Now, this seems like such a simple statement, but it was so astounding to me. I can't tell you how many experiments I conducted trying to determine which one of these drinks was the one that I couldn't take. And all these experiments had ended in nothing but dismal, embarrassing failure. And you said it's the first one. You explained to me about the concept of the allergy to alcohol. At the time, I couldn't buy that. I buy it now. I don't want to get off too much tonight because it is getting late, but I think this might be worth saying. Being a physician, I'm often asked by sincere AA members. It usually goes like this, Doc, why can't I drink? Why can't I drink? If I were as keen and sharp on some of the fundamentals of medicine as I used to be, we could take some blackboards and put them around up here, and we could start over here, and we could draw some real complicated formulas with carbon and hydrogen and oxygen involving the oxidase enzyme, glucose metabolism breakdown series, and end up over here with CO2 and water. When we got all through, I'd say, now, do you understand? No, I don't either. I don't either, but there it is, in black and white. But I can't explain to you why you can't drink, why it is you're allergic to alcohol. But whenever I think about this problem, whenever an AA member sincerely asks me this thing, I tell him what an old boy in Texas told me a long time ago, and he wasn't half as smart as I am. Mm-mm. Yeah. But he's a good AA member. He said, Doc, nobody knows what happens when Mother Nature takes a cucumber and turns it into a pickle. But she does it all the time. But there's one thing, Doc, that everybody knows. Once a cucumber is turned into a pickle is going to stay. There's no way you can de-pickle a pickle. And were I bold enough in view of my recent hurt feelings to introduce myself as I see fit, I wouldn't have said my name is Hell's, and I'm an alcoholic. I wouldn't have said my name is Dr. Ding-a-ling, and I'm a wine on a pill. I'd have said, my name is Hell, and I'm a pickle. And that would explain my allergy to alcohol. And that's that, as far as I'm concerned. I'm a pickle, and a pickle I'm going to stay. I can't be de-pickled. However, I didn't go to enough meetings to grasp the concept of the mental obsession. As I like to say, I'm queer in the head for booze, that's all. I mean, a lot of guys queer about different things, but me, it's booze. I have a mental obsession about alcohol. Somehow, someday, some way, I'm going to beat the game. The book says this is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The book says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. The book says some pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. In my case, death was almost the end result. I had this obsession. I had this pickle state. 3.5 months, because of what you told me, I don't touch the first drink. I don't get drunk. I get off Skid Row. I start wearing shirts, taking baths, shaving, brushing my teeth, and looking at girls. How normal can you get? One night, coming home from a date, the obsession that burned within me got a hold of me, and I stopped in a bar, and I deliberately had a glass of beer. And I sat back, and I waited for the all hell and damnation to come that you AAs had said was going to come if I touched one drop. Nothing happened. I think I burped. I went home, and I went to bed. I got up the next day, and I worked all day, did some surgery, felt fine. I was seeing this girl fairly frequently, and I had a date with her again the following night. After the date, stopped in the same bar. This time I had a double hooker of bourbon over ice with a little shot of soda water on top. Gulped it down, sat back, and waited for the atom bomb to hit. Nothing happened. Stomach got a little warm, felt a little, just a little nice glow, fingers tingled a little bit, but no atom bomb. I was thoroughly disgusted. The hell is this business about if you take one drop, you're allergic to it? I went home and I went to bed. The third night, I made the jail. From this point on, I could no more stop drinking than water would run uphill. I could see Skid Row coming right back up at me. I knew the Board of Medical Examiners was dogging every step I took. Being unable to stop drinking and reluctantly admitting it under duress, I left the state of California and I went to Texas, simply to escape the wrath of the Board of Medical Examiners. I happened to have a license to practice medicine and surgery in Texas. Let's be frank and candid, as we must be in AA. There's a lot of things wrong with me, but I'm not a Texan. But I had a license to practice in that state. I'd never been in any trouble there, and I went to Texas. The geographic cure, as we call it in AA. I'm not going to bore you with a recitation of what happened there. I don't think I could, without some help, recall it all anyway. But with some help one time, we sat down and figured out, and it worked out that I had moved 22 times in 18 months in Texas. And this gives you a capsule idea of what happened there. Now the book says, tell what you used to be like, and I've tried to do that. Now, the book says, tell what happened. And it was in Texas that it happened, thank God. In the little community that I ended up trying to practice medicine, whoa, back up. In the little community that I ended up taking pills and drinking booze, we got a new Episcopalian priest at our village church. I did not go to church to get any religious counsel. I had floated a loan at the local bank. I was arrears in my payment. I went in half sober one day to make some foolish apology to the banker as to why I was arrears in the payment on my note. And he asked me in the course of our conversation what church I went to. And since I was in Baptist and Methodist country, I thought it was perfectly safe by proudly enunciating that I was an Episcopalian. And by darn, he was not only the Episcopalian, he was the pillar of the local church. And he waved this note that I owed him in front of me and says, "See you in church Sunday, doctor?" "Yes, sir, be right there." And I made the big mistake. I went back to the church of my choice the following Sunday. And this was our new priest's first visitation with us. He held his first communion or mass that morning. And it was quite an affair. As I've said before, I think our priest was in our village 3 days when he discovered me and his flock. I became this young priest's number one evangelical project. This was his first church. He was right out of the seminary in New Haven. He came to us from the bishop in Dallas, all full of you-know-what and vinegar, and ready to go. I've often thought about him in relation to that statement made in the Bible where, you know, the carpenter had his critics. I've often thought that maybe they're a bunch of shills, but that doesn't matter. But these guys are always going around taking these pot shots at the carpenter's philosophy and his way of telling about something new in life. And one day, one of these critics of the carpenter said to him, he said, "How come it is that you always work with the bad guys? Work with the bad girls? You never go around and pet the good boys on the head? Well done, old chap. Well done. Well done. Always you're working with these no goods. How come?" And the carpenter answered his critic by saying, "Who of you, if he had 100 sheep and one went astray, wouldn't abandon the flock and seek out the stray sheep?" I decided I was that stray sheep so far as our priest was concerned. This guy dogged me. It was he who found out that 20 miles away, a little town called Hyco, Texas, there was an AA group that met on Tuesday night consisting of 6 loyal members. And every Tuesday night, here came Father Billings. And I went to the AA group meeting in Hyco, Texas. You don't argue with priests when they've got their zeal up. That's all there is to it. You know, I used to get deliberately drunk to louse him up, and he'd take me anyway. After about 4, 5, maybe 6 of these sessions, I don't know how many, the shining beacon of the Hyco, Texas AA group came to Father, and he said, "Father, we enjoy having you come to our meetings. You're welcome here any time. But as for your friend, that drunken doctor," I said, "Really, Father, we'd just as soon you leave him at home. He doesn't seem to want this thing, and we don't think we're helping him. Besides that, Father, he interrupts our meetings." Father had too much respect for Alcoholics Anonymous to ignore their wishes, and so for a while he didn't 12-step me anymore. And then one night, only God knows what I had taken in the way of booze and pills, or pills and booze. But my breathing stopped. My lips and fingernails began to turn a deep, dark, ominous blue. There were 2 people with me. They did everything they could think of to revive me. Nothing seemed to work. And finally, one of them happened to remember that I was an Episcopal. And since it looked like I had cashed in my chips, they sent for Father. He came rather quickly, and with one look, I am told, at my body, he immediately gave me the rite of extreme unction. Just as they say he was finishing this, I gave a grunt, or some made some kind of a little noise, and they decided that maybe I was not dead yet. And so Father took off his vestments, and he joined these other 2 people, and the 3 of them worked with me until some 4 o'clock, I am told, in the morning, at which time my breathing eventually started in again, and eventually then the blue color left my lips and nails. When this was over, Father went to the telephone and he called the Shining Beacon in Hyco. He told him what had happened, and he said, "Unless we do something, this man's going to destroy himself. He all but did it tonight." After much conversation, it was agreed that something should be done. The local AA group felt that there was nothing they had to offer, but maybe somebody else could take a crack at me with a different angle, a different gimmick. It might work. And so it came to pass that I was taken by Father Billings with a bottle of whiskey as the bait about a third of the way across the state of Texas to meet a man who'd been called in advance and was waiting on us. When we got there was about that much left in my bottle. Father Billings politely kicked me out of the car in the custody of this man with whom I was to spend 5 days. During the 5 days that I was with this man, he took the time to talk to me.
I think this is so important on a 12-step call, is to take the time to talk to the man, or the woman, as the case may be.
And in talking with me, all he did was talk about himself, typically alcoholic. He told me what he used to be like, and then eventually he told me what happened, and I stayed with him long enough to find a little of what he was like now or then. The interesting thing about this whole phenomenon was this man, like I, was a doctor of medicine. This man, like I, was a low-bottom chronic alcoholic. This man, like I, was a goofball addict. He not only took goofballs, he took the same goofballs that I took, the same way that I took. I had that strange phenomenon during the first few days that I was with him that some guys called this guy up and tipped him off, you know? I couldn't believe that there was such a parallelism. It took a while to shake this idea that nobody else was like me. And here was a guy who was reading my mail right down to the last letter T with a X on it. He, too, had been placed in a mental hospital, committed as insane. He, too, had gone all over his part of the country seeing wig pickers in and out of mental institutions seeking a solution to his problem. In other words, his story was nothing more than a repetition of my story, just in a different geographical setting. And he, like I, was a specialist in a different field than I, but he was a specialist and a doctor of medicine. However, there was one big difference between he and I. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was actively working this program, and he was sober, and he was clean, and he was happy. And his community, his medical profession, those who knew him, his family, everyone loved him. And he walked the streets of his community and his hospital in the corridor of his office, a free man, a contented, happy man. I can't tell you in words the exact feeling of emotional impact that this meeting this man had on me. We call this, in our erudite circles of Alcoholics Anonymous, where we get up there and talk to God and Bill Wilson and nobody else, we call this the phenomena of identification. And that's a big psychiatric word that actually describes it, but I like that old Texas expression about somebody's been reading my mail, because that's what it was for me. It was the recognition that there is someone like me. There are those who do have this problem, identical with mine, and they have found a solution through AA. I've often said I had a stubborn case of alcoholism. I didn't throw in the sponge that quick. I had to go through another 6 months that don't bear any real description for the edification of anyone, except to say that finally, thank God, the seed that this man had planted in me began to bear fruit or to show some signs of emergence from whatever soil it lay in and to create a structure. Thank God, of my own free will, I walked into the downtown, as they like to call it, but I prefer to call it the Skid Row because that's where it was, club. Now, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in the city of Fort Worth, Texas, at 10:30 in the morning, Central Standard Time, July the 21st, 1956. I had had that morning 3 glasses of wine in a Skid Row bar. As I said earlier in my remarks, I am not a Texan. That is not a defect of character that I possess. However, I found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in Texas, and during my remarks during the next few minutes, I think you'll see why, as a gesture of amends to those wonderful people in Texas, to show my friendship and appreciation for what they helped me do for myself, I carry this little Freudian love object around with me. That's the flag of the state of Texas. Whenever I go in AA anywhere, that goes with me. There was one guy on duty in the club that morning. I didn't look good. I didn't smell good. I didn't feel good. He said, "What do you want?" I said, "I want to stop drinking. Will you help me?" You know, he looked at me for a moment, and I thought he was going to say no. Instead, he said, "Will you do anything that I suggest?"
Thank God this insufferable alcoholic ego had temporarily been beaten down to a point where I could say in all sincerity, yes, I'll try. In a few minutes, he placed me in the Tarrantown jail. The AA groups in the less provident areas of Fort Worth, Texas, often encountering people such as I coming off Skid Row without money or resources, and as I was mired in debt, aren't able to provide hospitalization and treatment for every stumble-bum drunk that comes along. So they had worked out a system with the Tarrant County Sheriff's Department whereby a prospective AA member could be taken over and placed in the Tarrant County Jail without booking. He was given a large cell all alone, and he could stay there 5 days. This is often referred to in Texas AA as the iron treatment. But I'll tell you one thing, you get sober. You get sober. It ain't easy, but you get sober. You know, I have friends in Alcoholics Anonymous who are members of the Roman faith. I have other friends in Alcoholics Anonymous who are not necessarily the Roman faith, but some of these people, both Roman and non-Roman, often go off on these AA retreats. And every now and then my phone will ring and it's Tom or Jerry or some guy calling me and saying, Doc, yeah, we're going up to St. Timothy Watts this weekend to an AA retreat. Why don't you come and go with us? I usually am very polite, very courteous, very sincerely thank them for having asked me to go with them, but I decline. So far, in the 8 1/4, God willing, pushing 8 1/2 years of abstinence from alcohol, I haven't had to make a retreat yet. The reason why is because I made my retreat in the Tarrant County Jail. I had a big cell there. I was all alone in it. They shut off all the little apertures so that I was completely without any communication with the other parts of the jail. The only guy I saw for 5 days and 5 nights was a turnkey and a trustee. They would open the door, come in, bring me a tray of food, take out the tray from the previous meal. I must say this, the AA groups there had supplied me ample with cigarettes and matches, but that was the extent of my comfort. One can do a lot of thinking when one is one by oneself in a situation like this, and I can't tell you any more than the way I finally worked it out. I had had enough AA exposure to reluctantly admit that there were guys who were drunks who were smarter than I was who were staying sober in AA, damn it. I had to reluctantly admit that there were guys who had a lot more moxie than I could ever hope to have, who were alcoholic and who were staying sober in AA, damn it. And no matter what facet of a desirable personality the man might have, whether it was money, wealth, charm, intelligence, grace, physique, I had had enough AA exposure to know that there was a drunk who had me beat in that latitude and who was sober in AA. So I arrived at a very simple conclusion. There is nothing wrong with Alcoholics Anonymous, Buster. What in the hell is wrong with you? Other guys are smarter, brighter, more handsome, more charm, more money. They're sober, and they're doing it in AA. Who do you think you are? The answer didn't come right away. It has been said that this is a program of miracles, and I believe it. I wouldn't have believed in miracles before. But something happened in that jail cell that I shall never forget. I got terribly bored. The only thing available to read were a bunch of old grapevines. And I started in, for want of anything better to do, to pass the time reading these grapevines. Strange phenomena happened. I would pick up a grapevine and I would start to read through it, and just about the time when I was to discover whether Mary got her husband back or got her kid back that she'd lost through drinking, the damn page would be gone, I would never know what happened. And so I'd become infuriated and I'd flip over a couple of pages and I'd start another story in the grapevine.
Now, it didn't take long to discover something. If the story were there complete, if there were no coffee stains, spittle stains, torn pages, cigarette butt mashed on it or something, if the whole thing was there and I could read it through, I got a message. Just as though it were coming right up out of the page at me. If the story was interrupted, if the page was gone, if I never found out whether Joe got his Cadillac out of the lake or what happened, you know, no message. The message? Very simple. The third step of our program. The third step. Where we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand. Then I recognize why I couldn't stay sober. Why I couldn't accept AA. Why I had been unable to become an AA member and enjoy sobriety and work out my problems as these more brighter, more intelligent, better dressed, more charming people than I ever do. I'm not ashamed to tell you what in my case I did. I prayed lots of times. I prayed in jail. I prayed when I was puking. I prayed when the back of the John hit me on the head for the 10th time. I ended up on my knees on that jail floor. But I didn't say, oh God, get me out of this one and I'll do this for you. Oh God, please fix it over so and so so I can go back over there. I asked God, and I still have to ask Him for this, one day at a time. Please help me get this damn big fat ego of mine out of the way, and you run the show, please. I'm losing it. It's the only prayer an alcoholic can really make and stick by it. It's the one prayer that will work if he pushes and tries to let go and let God. On the fifth day, they came and got me. They took me back to the club. I think I said something intelligent to the club keeper. I think I said, when do we eat? He whirled around on me and he gave me what I still think was the finest, shortest, most hard-hitting AA pitch I've ever heard. Unfortunately, I can't remember it all. I believe that our program, as we try to apply it, is a positive program. It's a dynamic program. It has answers for those who seek it. But I think, too, we must recognize, and I think in some of our 12-step work with newcomers, it might be well if at the proper stage in their maturation we injected this little philosophy. There's a negative aspect to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and it's a very important negative aspect. And he gave it to me short but quick. In essence, here's what he told me. He said, Buster, if you're hungry and you need food, you'll have to go to a restaurant and get it. We don't serve meals in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not a handout. This is not a charity place to come and get free food. He said, by the way, if you need money, we haven't got any. You'll have to go someplace else for that. He went all right down all the various material things that each and every alcoholic at one time or another thinks is a solution to his drinking problem. If I could have this, I could stay sober. If I could have this, I could stay sober. If my wife had come back, if I had my home back, why did I have to lose the car? He went right down all these things. No, 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 no. And I must be frank and say he included a little lecture on an element called sex. AA doesn't solve your sex problems either, if you happen to have it. However, he did tell me at the conclusion of the lecture, and I'll never forget the word he used. He said, Buster, not doctor, Buster. If you've got a drinking problem, we've got the answer for it here. And maybe if you can do something about your drinking, then maybe you can figure out a way to get a meal, to get some money in your pocket, and to answer all these other things that seem to be troubling you, including sex. But first things first. And then he turned his back on me and walked away. First things first, let's get a job. I went over to the Texas Employment Commission and I registered for employment. Why is this important in my story? To me, it's very important. In our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it speaks of people whose minds are of the educational variety. You'll find it here. May God have mercy on such alcoholics. In 12-step work among members of my own profession, it seems to me this is the thing that nails so many of them to eternity. Those whose minds are the educational variety. People whose minds are the educational variety cannot grasp things that can't be measured with calibers, or stick a thermometer in and see what the temperature is, or float it in a solution and find out its specific gravity. These are ways we calibrate things, their temperature, their size, their specific gravity. Are they hot? Are they cold? Are they warm? Do they smell or not smell? Will they dissolve in this, that, and the other? Mind is such a mind as this. And my training as a physician had only further enhanced it. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the tools of therapy that we're dealing with are things that you can't take the temperature of. You can't measure their size. You can't find out whether they float or don't float, will dissolve in something or not dissolve in something, because these are things that are spiritual in nature. You can't wrap faith up in a package and mail it to somebody like you would a box of candy. It's a mighty sweet thing to have, but it won't go that way. You can't take love and send it in a telegram and have it hit the heart of the guy who gets the wire. You can try, but it takes actually expression of love to score. You can't take all these things that are spiritual in nature and put them materially in some way that is projected so as to be objective. In dealing with things spiritual in nature, we're being purely subjective. And for those that the book speaks of whose minds are the educational variety, oh, may God have mercy on them if they're alcoholic. Because these are the people who have such difficulty, it seems to me, in accepting this program of spiritual nature. Mind is such a mind. Had you walked up to me 15 years ago and said, do you really believe that a guy got swallowed by a whale, swam around his belly for 3 days, was puked up and lived? I'd have said, you had your cotton pick in mind. Go peddle your paper somewhere else. The hospital's over down the street. Somebody walked up to me a dozen or more years ago and said, do you know that there were a bunch of Jews trying to get out of Egypt? And the Egyptians decided at the last minute they didn't want to go after they told them they could, so they hot-footed it after them. And when they got to the Red Sea, the Egyptian army was at their back and the sea was in the front, and they did a little praying. The sea opened up and they went through, and the Egyptians came along trying to get them. Boom! We let it happen. God closed the ocean around them. I said, it's an allegorical tale told to illustrate a point. Like Grimm's fairy tales, you know, mysticism and myth, to get over the greatness of the higher power. I don't talk that way now. No. I decided that guy Jonah had a slip. God sent him back to his group where he belonged. Those fellows that were a bunch of running Jews were trying to make a meeting over on the other side of the sea, and they were too late to take the detour. God wanted to get them there because they had to put on the meeting that night. Yes, there are miracles. And the thing that so dynamically changed my thinking occurred this very day. I walk into the Texas Employment Commission seeking employment. I register and I sit down and wait for my name and number to be called. As an example to you of my new change in thinking, positive now in nature, I'll never forget sitting there waiting for my number to be called. I look down. And there was one of these large sand cigarette disposal units there, and they had the largest snipes in it I've ever seen. My new way of thinking was demonstrated when I thought to myself, well, if I don't get a job here today and come back anytime I want and get a good smoke. You see, my thinking was beginning to change. However, these are the facts. You draw your own conclusion. Let me just try to paint the clinical picture for you. Later, by actual count, it was determined that there were approximately 40 desks in this rather large bureaucratic office, behind which sat 40 interviewers employed by the state of Texas, working 40 hours a week, except for time off for coffee breaks, stub toes, gossip, lunchtime, sick leave, and what have you. But theoretically, there are 40 employees, bureaucrats of the state of Texas, working in there 40 hours a week. At a moment in history, my name was called. I stepped forward to the little girl who was directing traffic, the receptionist. She looked up. Now get this. At that very moment, one desk of the 40, 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, came open. She said, "There's someone who can see you over there right now." I went, by chance, I went to this one open desk, 40 hours a week, 40 people, 52 weeks a year. I sat down opposite a lady, total stranger. I handed her my application. She started to read. I reached over, I pressed it to the blotter on our desk, and I said, "Lady, don't bother reading that. It doesn't tell the truth." I said, "As the application indicates, I am a physician. I am licensed to practice in this state, and I'm without employment. But," I said, "that's not the important thing." I said, "The important thing is that I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict." I said, "Now, I haven't had any drugs in about 6 months, and I hadn't since my encounter with that doctor that I mentioned in East Texas. I said, "But I've been having one awful time with my drinking." I said, "5 days ago, to a total stranger now, a woman, 5 days ago I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I just got out of jail this morning. You see, I thought you had to go to jail to join AA. I didn't know anything. I later learned different. But I thought it was a part of the initiation, you know. I said, 5 days ago, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I just got out of jail this morning. I said to this total strange woman, one person in 40 hours a week. I said, "Now, I don't know whether I can stay sober or not. But they tell me you only have to do it one day at a time, and I'm sober now." Smile came on her face. A little fat, warm hand came across to take mine. "My name is Tebow, doctor. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. How are you?" Those whose minds are of the educational variety, who have to have everything measured, put in its place, organized, heat, temperature, God have mercy. There are miracles in this way of life. If you have an educational mind and you're so plagued with this obsession, take it home tonight. Get your logarithms out. Get your computers out. Monday morning, go down to the IBM place. They'll be glad to kick it around on a couple of cards for you. Statistically, it can't happen. But it did happen. It did happen. I remember Tebow and I talked for a while. She said, "You know, doctor, it's not every day we have an alcoholic pillhead doctor coming in here looking for work." I said, "We're going to have a little trouble placing you." So since I don't have a job for you right away, she said, "How would you like to go to an AA meeting with me tonight?" "I'd love to, Tebow." And so she took me to an AA meeting that night. And at the meeting, she explained to those there that I needed employment. One guy asked me if I had ever washed dishes. I said, "Sure, why?" He said, "How would you like a job as a dishwasher?" "I'll take it." "Where? When?" He told me where and when to meet him the next day downtown Fort Worth. And at 10 o'clock, the appointed hour, I was standing in front of this restaurant, which is a large sign, "Dishwasher Wanted." The guy's name was Al. He came up. He said, "Let's go inside. Let's meet the boss." We went in. He ordered 2 cups of coffee, put a dime on the counter. I sat back. I'm learning AA real fast. He ordered, let him pay for it. We sipped our coffee, the boss came in, he called the boss over, he introduced me to the boss, said, "This is the fellow I've been telling you about." And he said, "Excuse me a minute, Hal." And he went up to the cash register at the front of the store. And he and the boss engaged in an intimate conversation. It was July, it was Texas, it was hot. I remember I looked in the kitchen in the back and there was a mound of dishes 10 feet high, dirty, and steam pouring out of the place. And I remember I looked down into my unfinished cup of coffee. And I spoke to God as I was beginning to try to understand. I said, "God, if it's necessary for me to wash dishes to stay sober, please let me accept it and do a damn good job as a dishwasher. The important thing is to stay sober." About that time, I felt a hand on my shoulder. It was Al. He said, come on, we're going. I get out on the street, and I grab Al, and I said, what's the idea? He said, there was a job in there. You know, I need a job. Man, I got to eat. I got, oh, these things got bread, boy, you know. Al said, come on, you're not going to work as a dishwasher. I've got a job for you. It's not washing dishes. I said, well, Al, will you tell me something? Why did we go through that dishwashing routine in there? And he said these words to me. Here's what he said. He said, Hal, I was just testing you for your sincerity. Now that I know that you mean business, I'll do anything I can to help you. And sure enough, he had a job waiting on me. I became a shoe salesman that morning. But it beats washing dishes. My story from this point on is a story of slowly, one day at a time, trying to make some spiritual progress. The book says it ain't easy, and it isn't. I've had no drinking problems since July 21st, 1956. My problem now is what my problem was then, and always will be, me. I'd like to close this remarks that let me have the privilege of making here tonight with a little simple story that indicates my feeling about this whole business. Early in his ministry, the master was stopped by two men on a highway who said to him, O son of David, have mercy on us. And the carpenter, the little Jewish carpenter, stopped. From this point on, I like to divert from the version is given in Holy Writ, and just give my own, as I understand it. The carpenter stopped and he said, what do you characters want? And these two men were blind, and they must have clutched at their eyes in their desperation, as blind men would do. And they said, O son of David, make us see. I can have a certain empathy for those men because, you know, I had the blindness of the soul. And I'm sure in their desperation and their agony, they were suffering as much as you and I ever suffered. Self-pity was their justified lot. Resentment must have plagued the living hell out of them. O son of David, make us see. This Jewish carpenter, who was capable of such tremendous 12-step work, looked at these poor devils and he said, do you believe that I can do this? Do you believe that I can do this? They said, yea, master, we believe. Whereupon it is recorded in Holy Writ that he touched their eyes and these blind men saw a miracle. I always like to tell that story and then say, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Thank you and God bless you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.